Hello, and welcome to Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm David Rogowski, and today I will be reading from Outside Magazine. Okay, our first article is entitled, The Cult of the Mountain Town Weatherman. Alpine communities have had their own microclimates, which makes forecasting a tricky business. In a local fixation, who dares try their hand? A few brave amateur meteorologists, we talked to one of the most popular to find out why. It's by Heather Hansman. On a Sunday afternoon in October, I snuck out for a run. It was tank top weather when I left my house in downtown Durango, Colorado, and I expected it to hold. I drove north into the mountains, and as I crested a hill 15 minutes in, the sky turned gray and cracked with lightning. The temperature reading in my car dropped 20 degrees, and the rain hitting the windshield was so thick I could hardly see the road. My phone buzzed in the cup holder. It was a text from the friend I was meeting. WTF DWG. DWG stands for Durango Weather Guy. The nom de plume of Jeff Givens, a local real estate agent turned amateur meteorologist who has much more power over my life than anyone running a WordPress blog should. His website offers weather forecasts, blow-by-blows of storms, and roundups of precipitation totals with a heavy dose of personal opinion. Sometimes the posts are excited updates. Saturday, 4:30 a.m. It's not over yet. The closed low pressure is spinning over Arizona early this morning. Sometimes they'll take a deep dive into the variability of La Nina, the cooling pattern in the Pacific Ocean that tends to bring dry winters to Southwest or the difference between Canadian and European forecasting models. Sometimes they'll answer requests from fans who ask for specific forecasts within their individual microclimates. In the forecast the day after my Sunday soak-in, Givens walked back what he posted the day before, responding to the razzing he'd received from readers. You don't get that from the Weather Channel. Followers who subscribe to his email list might get three updates a day when storms are firing, sometimes timestamped 3 a.m., 9 a.m., then noon. I read every one. And I'm not alone. Givens has 19,100 subscribers. The local population is about 19,500, and that includes children. Givens is more accurate than any other weather source around here, and that makes him arguably the biggest celebrity in my smallish town. Our collective excitement crescendos with his forecasts, and whether they lead to joyful or disappointing experiences outside, we piece together a postmortem in the days that follow. Sometimes he sends the whole town into a spiral. Like any forecaster, occasionally he's wrong. I'm on multiple ski planning text chains that dissect his accuracy. He never admits when he's wrong, one friend complained. I just don't like his syntax, another told me. While her husband admitted to obsessively reading every post. Too many emails, several others said. How can you get mad at him? He's doing it for free, someone countered. He is a common denominator, a full cure and a prophet, and a person to blame when your plans go to shit. Everyone I know has an opinion about his forecast. And I mean literally everyone. Yesterday at the doctor, as I shivered in my gown, the nurse asked me how the weather had been on the way over. Durango weather guy says it's supposed to get bad this weekend, she said, unprompted. I needed to understand how this faceless man had become ubiquitous and a mercurial guru and wormed his way into the brains and hearts of my community. So I emailed Givens and asked him to meet me. It's not just my town that's fascinated by the people who predict the weather. Meteorologists are some of the public's most trusted sources for news, more than any other figure in print and TV reporting, according to a 2022 poll from The Economist and market research company YouGov. Most broadcast meteorologists have at least a bachelor's degree in the field, but in tricky pockets where the Weather Channel struggles to get it right, people like me are turning to locals who may not be formally credentialed. It's hard to forecast the weather correctly in funky geographies. Mountains generally create more extreme weather, and the variability in conditions is high over short distances. Joel Gratz, the founder of Open Snow, tells me, valleys are different than summits. One side of a mountain will be different than another. The forecasting technology is less accurate in varied terrain. If you live in Durango, the local National Weather Service Forecasting Center is in Grand Junction, 150 miles and four mountain passes away. Because of the curvature of the Earth, the Doppler radar can't see weather in Durango coming in below 28,000 feet or so. Most storms sneak in under that horizon. This is where someone like Givens comes in. Durango Weather Guy is far from the only small-town weather guru with a cult following. In Park City, a financial planner named Michael Ruzek tracks what he calls the Powder Buoy, a NOAA weather tracking float nearly 200 miles off the coast of Kauai. When the buoy rises, he tells his 45,000 Instagram followers to plan for a powder day in the Wasatch in about 2 weeks. He says that historically he's been right about 80% of the time. In Whistler, meteorologist David Jones, also known as Powder Picker, posts high-energy video predictions for thousands of skiers in the Coast Range. And at Open Snow, Gratz has made a business by building a network of independent, often non-traditionally trained local weather forecasters like Brian Allegretto, who was working as an accountant in Tahoe before he started Tahoe Weather Discussion in 2008 and merged with Open Snow in 2011. He sends the Tahoe area into a frenzy when he predicts a big storm. In Utah, Gratz scooped up Evan Thayer, another amateur meteorologist who started a weather blog after the forecasting emails he sent to friends started circulating to hundreds of people. Outdoorsy residents of places like Tahoe and Durango may end up in a particularly close parasocial relationship with their local weather person because the weather they predict has a big impact on their lives. If you prioritize being outside, especially if you live in a place where raging heat, big snowstorms, and wild monsoons are all common, your daily decisions and even your general psyche follow the curve of the weather forecast. We depend on it not just for recreation, but as a reassurance that the river will still run through the summer or the wildfire season might be mild. This level of emotional investment may be why local weather gurus can at times evoke ire. Howard Schechter, a legendary forecaster in Mammoth, who began writing local forecasts on the chalkboard of the ski shop where he worked as a boot fitter in the 80s, said he was once burned in effigy for getting forecasts wrong. But those individuals also inspire unique devotion. When Schechter, who eventually moved his forecasts onto Eastern Sierra Weather Blog in the 2000, passed away last August, fans in droves eulogized him online. Howard was the one person really paying attention to our reality here, local reporter Wendelin Grassecci wrote. Our unique challenges and issues that we all deal with due to our weather extremes. Once I made plans to meet up with Durango weather guy, I almost didn't want to show. It felt like pulling back the curtain on the Wizard of Oz. My group chats had ideas of what he'd be like. I bet he's secretly some young tech bro, one friend said. I bet he has a fortress of screens in his basement. I'm picturing him like Homer Simpson at the nuclear plant, said another. On a gray morning 3 weeks after I got rained out with the first real winter storm of the season rolling in, Givens met me for coffee. He walked in a couple of minutes after I did and settled in across the table from me. I almost missed him. When he came in, he's tall but unimposing, 60 years old and soft-spoken. Though he was quick to answer questions and maybe even a little nervous, he wore a crisp-collared Hawaiian shirt while patrons wearing Patagonia and Ripton trickled into the coffee shop. He seemed like an avuncular math professor, the kind who wants you to do well but is a stickler for details and won't let you off easy. The Wizard of Oz turned out to be a real person, one who takes his volunteer role very seriously. I almost immediately felt bad for all the times I made snarky jokes about his accuracy. Givens told me that he runs his operation at home from an office where he sorts through various weather models on 4 different monitors. When I asked what they looked like, he ran out to his car to grab a tablet so he could show me the models he checks every morning and sometimes in the middle of the night. Before he was Durango weather guy, Givens was just a kid in Iowa, obsessed with tornadoes and snowstorms. During his childhood in the 70s, his family would come to Colorado to ski. He remembers being amazed by how much snow could fall so quickly. He moved to Denver in 1992 for a job in investment banking. Still intrigued by those storms, several years later he and his wife, who he met right after he moved to Colorado, decamped for the edge of Echo Mountain in Idaho Springs, where the Front Range foothills transitions to big mountains. They lived at 10,200 feet, and the local weather forecast never quite matched what he was seeing, so he taught himself to understand precipitation patterns by reading National Weather Service discussions online, where federal forecasters explain their predictions. The good thing about those is that when there's a weather term, they'll highlight it and you can click on it and learn it. And if you're passionate about it, you'll remember it, he told me. He was passionate. He memorized all the vocabulary and then subscribed to various weather data providers like WeatherBell Analytics and Weather Models, pulling together details to make his own forecast. He loved trying to figure out why some storms would hit and some would miss. Eventually, he and his wife grew tired of the Front Range and sought out a quieter life in Durango. By 2010, after they had moved, he was driving his wife crazy with constant weather talk. She politely told him to direct it toward someone who cared. He began posting to Facebook. His audience grew quickly, especially after a 2018 wildfire burned 55,000 acres north of town, and locals became more concerned about extreme weather. He set up the blog soon after. Givens doesn't ski anymore because of an old ankle injury, but he still has the obsessive focus of a powder hound. In the coffee shop, he opens WeatherBell Analytics, one of the commercial forecasting services he uses, and pulls up a map that shows precipitation predictions in 6-hour increments. He uses these maps to see how fronts move over the mountains and deposit moisture. I watch blobs of color modeled storms move across the screen, blanketing Utah and Arizona. He says that since he's started looking at weather, the availability of data and models has increased exponentially. Amateurs like him now have access to incredibly high-resolution maps. The challenge is interpreting all that information. It's not fancy, but it works, because I cover such a small area, Givens said. If someone asks me what's happening in Aspen, I'm not even going to try. He covers a quadrant that stretches east from the desert town of Cortez, Colorado, to often snow-hammered Wolf Creek Pass, and extends north from Aztec, New Mexico, through Telluride to Ridgeway, Colorado. That zone encompasses most of the southern San Juan Mountains, including some of the weather-prone passes in the country. Some of the most weather-prone passes in the country. The elevation ranges from 14,308 foot on Compagre Peak to the dry desert of northern New Mexico, 10,000 feet below. It's a lot to be familiar with from a forecasting perspective because the terrain changes so fast. The model he shows me analyzes one 9x9 mile square at a time. Around here, that makes a big difference, he said, gesturing at a screen. Learning the intricacies of local terrain and storm timing took years, and he's still mastering it. Early on, I would watch storms coming in from the north, but eventually learned that it's a southwest flow that delivers the biggest storms here, he said. The nearby ski destination of Telluride can benefit from northwest flow, he said, but for the rest of the region, that pattern just kind of dries out and the wind blows like crazy. Meteorology is pattern recognition, and Givens has become our most reliable local source because he's memorized the trends. Givens has a highly interactive relationship with the community. He shares information and people respond with their own reports. Every day that there's a drop of rain or a flake of snow, I'll get an email, he told me. When nothing is happening, I still get 20 emails a day. If he doesn't post for a couple of days and the weather is calm, he'll get concerned messages. I have a bunch of second moms out here, he said. Based on his interactions, he thinks that about 60% of his readers are women. When youth sport teams have travel games, parents and coaches check his predictions before heading up the mountain passes, and people hire him to forecast for their weddings. He's become inescapable even from himself. Sometimes when I go to the grocery store, I can hear people talking about me, he said. I asked him if he ever felt like people held him responsible when he got the forecast wrong. He laughed a little. Not as responsible as I hold myself, he said. What started as a personal hobby has turned into a public service. Givens' forecasts are accurate enough that it's not just worried sports parents and weirdos with their own snow stakes who are checking in. He told me that the sheriff's office and local search and rescue groups will ask for his outlook when they're in the field. Regional avalanche forecasters in the Colorado Department of Transportation also make sure that he has their latest travel reports to include in his forecast. Now I get emails from the people who lock the gates on the passes when they're closed because of avalanche danger, he said, referring to the Colorado Department of Transportation. That's handy. Planning around the weather as someone who's as active and can feel both accessible and slightly mystical. We have predictions, but we can never fully get it right. Yet it's reassuring to know that someone is closely monitoring the hyper-local way the winds are blowing. Durango Weather Guy helps us manage one aspect of our uncertain future. He's both a source of information and a scapegoat. And now that I've gone behind the curtain, I'll take him for granted less. By the time I was done with my coffee, patchy sunlight was pushing through the clouds. Givens rushed off. It was his wife's birthday, plus there was a storm coming in. As he headed to his car, he said, I have to get an afternoon forecast out today. And that was by contributing editor Heather Hansman, who's the author of Powder Days and Down River. The surprising cause of Hawaii's snorkeling deaths. Snorkeling deaths caused by rapid onset pulmonary edema may be as common or more so than accidental inhalation of water. It's by Jen Murphy. Hawaii's tumbling waterfalls, craggy lava fields, and palm-shaded beaches are undeniably enchanting, but the island's true beauty lies beneath the surface of the sea. When I slip on fins, a mask, and snorkel and dive into the ocean, another world reveals itself. Green turtles munching seagrass, neon-hued parrotfish, and wrasses darting between colorful corals, and certain months, a symphony of humpback whales. The captivation of seeing sea creatures up close explains why snorkeling is so popular. According to the Hawaiian Ocean Safety Team, a nonprofit dedicated to making the state's water safer and cleaner, approximately 3 million people snorkel in Hawaiian waters each year. Most people won't be surprised to learn how many people enjoy such an accessible, wonderful activity, but what's shocking is how dangerous it can be and the consistent number of snorkeling fatalities. According to the Hawaii State Department of Health, drowning is the leading cause of death for visitors, far outpacing the national average. Around 45 tourists drowned in the ocean each year in Hawaii between 2019 and 2023, and snorkeling was the number one contributor. This year has proved especially deadly. In March, a 43-year-old visitor from California drowned while snorkeling in Kauai at unguarded Larson's Beach, and Oahu saw two snorkel-related tourist deaths the first week of February. 64-year-old woman snorkeling off a Turtle Bay resort on the North Shore, and a 35-year-old man who was part of a kayak tour. While these incidents were terrible, they also didn't shock me. I live part-time in Maui and regularly see panicked snorkelers. In February, I watched an older gentleman crawl out of the water onto the beach as he was pounded by shore break in his snorkel gear. Later that month, I witnessed a young woman struggle to remove her mask after it filled with water. Despite the dangers, many snorkelers appear to lack safety training or an understanding of their gear. I regularly observe people wearing fins backwards and snorkels upside down. Underestimating the skills required to snorkel. Some visitors mistakenly think a snorkel is a flotation device, said Andy McComb, founder of the Red Lion Rafting, a tour operator in Maui that runs snorkel excursions. He said his team is asked almost daily, do I need to know how to swim in order to snorkel? Swimming is challenging enough for some people. Add a claustrophobic mass, a straw-like snorkel, fins that can weigh you down, plus waves and strong currents can lead to a casual activity quickly turning into a high-intensity workout. When people come to Hawaii, they see beauty, not danger, said Jason Bitzer, a former Honolulu Ocean Safety member who spent 6 years lifeguarding at snorkel spot hotspot Hanama Bay. Visitors think snorkeling is a controlled activity like ziplining. The ocean is in control. Even in the calm, flat waters of Hanamana Bay, water can be entered through the top of the snorkel. People panic. Instead of pulling the snorkel out of their mouth to spit out the water, they start to suck it in and choke, said Shane Enright, a spokesperson for Honolulu Ocean Safety. That's how a drowning can start, even in harmless-looking ocean conditions. A common misconception is that snorkeling is effortless and relaxing. It can be for some people, but for those new to the activity, it can be overwhelming and exhausting too. You need to have coordination, some fitness, and awareness of your surroundings, even if you're in 3 feet of flat water, said Enright. Just like riding a bike, it takes practice to get comfortable. Why do experienced snorkelers drown? It's easy to blame inexperience on the unusually high number of deaths, but many fatalities have involved experienced swimmers and snorkelers, like Ray Johnson. In February 2022, Johnson, then 64, took his fifth vacation to Hawaii with his wife Patty and four friends. The Michigan couple had snorkeled the waters of Hawaii many times before. Patty told me Ray was an incredible snorkeler. It's what he loved to do, she said. We planned vacations around snorkeling. He'd snorkel the lakes in Michigan, always kept his fins and snorkel in the car. On February 25th, 2 days after their arrival, Ray and some friends went snorkeling off Wailea Beach in Maui, which fronted their resort, the Fairmont Kealana. Patty had taken a walk along the paved path that overlooks the beach. I looked out and waved and then realized it looked like people were helping him, she recalled. I assumed he stepped on a lava rock. She rushed down to the beach, but by then, she said, he was on his back and being pulled out of the water. Someone called 911, but medical professionals weren't able to resuscitate him. The autopsy report deemed Ray's death an accidental drowning, which Patty said she doesn't believe. The friends who had been snorkeling with Ray told her at one point, he said, you gotta help me, I'm having trouble breathing. That's when they decided to head to shore, she said. I don't think you're having a conversation if you're drowning, she rationalized. The Johnson family believes the real cause of Ray's death was a lesser-known medical condition called rapid onset pulmonary edema, or ROPE, which causes fluid buildup in the lungs. In 2024, Patty filed a lawsuit against the Hawaii Tourism Authority, Hawaii Visitor Center, Hawaii Visitors and Convention Bureau, and the Fairmont Kealana, where Ray rented the gear, alleging that Hawaii travel entities failed to educate the public on this important public health concern. According to the complaint filed in the Circuit Court of the First Circuit in the state of Hawaii, Patty's Oahu-based lawyer, Jay Stumke, told me the case is still in the discovery phase and his trial is currently set for November. The Hawaiian Tourism Authority, Hawaii Visitors and Convention Bureau, and Fairmont Kealana declined to comment on the lawsuit. What is ROPE and how does it affect snorkelers? Years of data from Hawaii Department of Health revealed that many snorkel-related fatalities occurred in the mild ocean conditions and were not accompanied by signs of distress. In October 2017, the state established a snorkel safety subcommittee to investigate the unusual circumstances. A 2-year snorkel safety study conducted by the subcommittee and funded by the Hawaii Tourism Authority tested 50 different snorkels, reviewed medical examiner reports and case studies, and conducted a survey of 131 snorkelers at Hanamana Bay. The study was the first to link ROPE to snorkeling. Findings released in 2021 concluded that the rapid onset pulmonary edema in snorkelers may be as common or more so than the accidental inhalation of water, which typically causes someone to react in distress. When snorkeling, we breathe against more resistance than we typically would, explained Dr. Malin Hahn, chief of the Division of Pulmonary and Critical Care at the University of Michigan Health. When the body tries to inhale but is unable to do so or is hard to do so, it creates increased negative pressure within the lungs, she said. This encourages fluid to cross over from the blood into the lungs. When this occurs, the person can lose too much oxygen and become unconscious. ROPE associated with snorkeling can certainly be fatal, said Dr. Hahn, who noted that there is very little literature on this topic. The snorkel safety study suggested that pre-existing medical conditions, increased exertion, exposure to high altitudes, and the degree of the snorkeler's resistance to inhalation may increase risk of ROPE while snorkeling. It also suspected that prolonged air travel might be a factor given the majority of travelers have flown at least 5 hours to reach Hawaii. However, data was not conclusive, and the subcommittee recommended further research of this hypothesis. The study also recommends developing a statewide public education program to address snorkeling safety. According to a spokesperson for the Hawaii Visitor and Convention Bureau, only general ocean safety posters are in the island airports, and beach signs have been created to warn against everything from dangerous shore breaks to jellyfish, but very few are specific to snorkel safety. Because Hanama Bay State Park is a snorkel haven, visitors are required to watch a 7-minute orientation video that warns, snorkeling is a strenuous activity that requires good physical condition and skillful practice. It is critical to your safety that you have strong swimming abilities before entering the ocean. The state's ocean safety website has a dedicated snorkel section with printable brochures and includes a footnote about how causes of snorkel-related drownings, including air travel, are currently under investigation. Patty Johnson said she and her husband had never seen this brochure, nor had they been warned of these of any of these potential risks while snorkeling in Hawaii, particularly the concern around flying. She said she has since heard of snorkelers being warned to wait a few days after air travel in Cancun, Curacao, and Thailand. Patty now distributes business cards with warnings about air travel and snorkel-related rope to friends and sporting goods stores. My main goal in life is to educate people and hopefully get to get Hawaii to start educating people, she said. Should you be wary of full face mask? Generally speaking, you want a simple snorkel design that's easy to breathe from, said Dr. Han. You don't want to be pulling against a lot of resistance, she said. Of the 50 masks and snorkels tested in the snorkel safety study, only 4 were full face masks, which allow the user to breathe through their nose and mouth and typically feature a tube at the forehead. The study concluded that the full-face snorkeling mask had no inherent advantage or disadvantage in terms of resistance. However, it did have drawbacks. Users cannot spit out the mouthpieces, nor are they able to dive beneath the surface safely. They can't be removed easily in an emergency. Water can't be cleared from the tube often located at the top of the mask by blowing sharply, and the study found valve malfunction could lead to serious breathing impairments. I personally have found full-face masks, even those with quick-release mechanism, very hard to take off, and feel that you should always choose a safer rather than the more comfortable gear option. Colin Yamamoto, a subcommittee member and former battalion chief of ocean safety for the Maui Department of Fire and Public Safety, said he conducted his own research on full face masks versus traditional face masks and found the former to be far riskier. I'm not a scientist, he said, but my theory is that you are breathing in higher levels of carbon dioxide with a full face mask. That coupled with low oxygen levels is problematic if you are older or have pre-existing medical conditions. A small 10-person study conducted by Duke University in 2021 was inconclusive about whether full face masks were responsible for more snorkel drownings, but it did raise safety concerns around the lack of regulation and control of these masks. The Ocean Safety website includes a section about the pros and cons of using a full face mask and links to a paper from Dr. Monty Downs, president of the Kauai Lifeguard Association, which he opinioned. Don't use full-face snorkel masks unless you are an expert who's had a lot of training and experience with them. Many tour companies in Hawaii have independently banned the use of full-face mask snorkels, and tourism boards, such as the one for Turks and Caicos, now warn visitors of the risk of full-face mask snorkels. Snorkel Safety 101. The following is a list of tips I curated from recommendations listed on the Hawaii Department of Health Ocean Safety Passage Honolulu Ocean Safety Members and Snorkel Tour Operators. Check ocean conditions and only snorkel at guarded beaches. The chance of a rescue and resuscitation is much higher at a guarded beach, said Enright of Honolulu Safety. Never go alone. Always have a buddy. Inexperienced snorkelers should consider booking with a tour operator. Rest a day or two after flying. I never suggest anyone go straight from the plane to do any activity, whether snorkeling or surfing, said Enright. Many visitors come here dehydrated and need to acclimate to the different climate. Give your body time to regulate. Test your gear on dry land or even in a pool before jumping into the ocean. Your fins and mask should have a snug yet comfortable fit. Practice breathing through the snorkel. Know how to clear water from your snorkel and what to do if your mask leaks or fogs. Make sure you can scissor kick with your fins while swimming. A doggy paddle or frog kick won't cut it. Don't wear your fins on the beach or boat. Walk into the water first, get past the shore break, then put them on. Similarly, take them off before you exit the water. Go slow, breathe slowly, and keep your heart rate low. Don't overexert yourself. That was an article on snorkeling desk, and Jen Murphy is a regular contributor outside and a snorkel fanatic. Lives part-time in Maui, where she snorkels any chance she gets. In her 20s, she worked a short stint as a snorkel assistant aboard a catamaran, where she regularly fielded questions such as, do I really need to get my face wet to snorkel? And next up, 2 articles on shoes and running. First, what exactly is a super trainer? You know the shoes Ruth Chepngetich and Eliud Kipchoge wear, partially responsible for some of the fastest marathon times ever recorded? Those are called super shoes. They're thick-soled with ultralight, hyper-responsive foam midsoles embedded with carbon fiber plates. Think of super trainers as a more easygoing but still light and responsive cousin of super shoes. We sliced one open at our gear lab in Colorado to find out what makes them go zoom. 1. The midsole foam. The heart of every super shoe and super trainer is a thick slab of high-tech foam that's lighter, softer, and bouncier than any other midsole material to date. It's created by a process called supercritical foaming that combines heat, pressure, and liquid gas to infuse bubbles into elastic polymers like PBA, TPEE, and ATPU. The resulting midsoles deliver plush cushioning and trampoline-like rebound, but are squishy and unstable, requiring a balanced, powerful stride to optimize performance. Super shoes have full stacks of these soft, bouncy foams. However, many super trainers, like the Puma Deviate Nitro 3, shown here, use a combination of foams, softer on top of firmer, to provide an energetic feel while delivering the kind of stride-supporting ride more suitable for a training shoe. The step-in feels soft underfoot, but when put through a heel compression test used to compare super shoes at the outside lab, the Deviate Nitro 3 super trainer was less squishy than all the racers we tested. Traditional trainers use foams that are firmer and more supportive, or are soft but not as bouncy. usually EVA or an EVA blend, delivering a more grounded rolling ride. And part two is the plate. All super shoes have a rigid curved carbon fiber plate embedded in the midsole. While many assume that this acts like a spring, research has shown that its role is to moderate the foam squish and channel its rebound, reducing energy loss and facilitating powerful push-offs. Super trainers also typically have an embedded plate, but one with more flex. While rigid plates provide the most pop, they also dictate how the shoe rolls forward and can negatively alter the stride. A super trainer's plate, like the one in the adjacent Deviate Nitro 3, made of a carbon composite weave with a forked forefoot shape, accommodates a wider range of paces and strides and is less prone to bouncing feet in unproductive directions when form deteriorates from fatigue. Plates differ in flex, shape, and location within the foam. This affects how the foot rolls and interacts with the ground, and each feels different when combined with the runner's unique stride. 3. The rocker. With thick foam in many of today's running shoes, the sole no longer flexes much at the ball of the foot. Instead, its height allows designers to cut away mass under the toe, creating a rocker shape. Rather than enabling the foot to flex as it moves through the stride, that shape allows the runner to roll off the toe while the foot remains in a neutral position. The rocker's starting point, slope, and relationship to the plate all affect the shoe's ride. In our measurements, the Deviate Nitro 3's rocker started 8% later, closer to the toe, than the rocker on Puma's Fast R Nitro 2 racing super shoe, providing a stable forefoot stance before rolling forward. And 4. The outsole. A 3mm thick rubber outsole covers more than 90% of the forefoot and all of the contact areas of the heel on the Deviate Nitro 3. This provides better grip and durability than the sole of a racer, which needs to be as light as possible and so has rubber only in small optimized zone. And 5. The upper. Super shoe racers have minimal uppers with scant padding and strong, secure grip to hold the foot in place at speed. A super trainer's upper is more plush and durable, but still lightweight, thanks to strategically placed fabrics that stretch, breathe, or support as needed. And that was about a super trainer by Jonathan Beverly. Unfortunately, we have run out of time. We'll have to cover the other shoe article next week. Stay tuned. You have been listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and I've been reading from Outside Magazine. My name is Dave Rogowski. Thank you for listening.